Aloha and welcome to the conversation. It's been an eventful day for U.S. diplomacy and a dramatic several days. As you've been hearing this morning on NPR, President Trump has fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, naming CIA Director Mike Pompeo as his successor. This comes days after the stunning announcement that President Trump has accepted an offer to meet face-to-face with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un with a target date of sometime in May. Joining us with his insights this morning, retired Air Force Lieutenant General Dan Leaf. He served as Deputy Commander of U.S. Pacific Command here on Oahu, later Director of the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, and joins us this morning in the studio. General, thanks for coming in.
Aloha. Thank you for having me.
We'll get to North Korea in a moment, but I first wanted to get your thoughts on the firing of the Secretary of State this morning. The action itself, not a shock, but the timing seems surprising. What do you make of
that? The timing does seem surprising, but these things happen in an unpredictable way. And certainly it's of some concern with the meeting between Kim Jong-un and President Trump looming, but there are a lot of capable people in the State Department and elsewhere in the executive branch who can navigate their way towards this.
Secretary of State generally does play a key role in, mm-hmm. in prepping for a meeting like that. So if you assume that Pompeo comes in, he's coming from CIA, obviously a lot mm-hmm. of experience recently in terms of North Korea. Any shifts or change or difference in your view on that?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, Bill, so
it's
hard to say, but I'll say there's still continuity in the career foreign service and security folks and the military who will provide advice on this. So the Secretary's advice likely would have been very strategic, but the nuts and bolts will come from people who've been giving the nuts and bolts. There was another departure a couple weeks ago that was significant, and that is Ambassador Joe Yoon, former U.S. Ambassador to Malaysia, who was the special representative on North Korea matters. He's a good friend, so I'm biased, but a very capable diplomat, and the loss of his input is unfortunate. That said, the meeting looms, and they've got to get ready for it and figure out what the United States should seek out of such a meeting.
So what was, in terms of your reaction initially to hearing this news, how did you take it, what do you make of it, and where do we go?
I can't share my reaction on the radio. I was very surprised at the substance of the announcement by ROK, National Security Advisor Chung, in a good way. I think it's a great opportunity, but there were several things that Chung said about Kim Jong-un that were unprecedented. First, he said that Kim Jong-un expressed his commitment to denuclearization. Okay, that's one unprecedented point. Secondly, that he'll refrain from further missile and weapons tests, point two. And the one that really made me almost fall off my sofa as I watched with great anticipation this announcement was the statement, quote, he understands that routine joint military exercises between the Republic of Korea and the United States must continue. That was the wow moment for me, because the North Koreans have used those exercises as a stalking horse for decades mm-hmm. and have gotten the Republic of Korea and the United States in the past to postpone or indeed cancel a major exercise and then immediately embarked on some other provocation that made us look silly. So that preemptive pledge to allow exercises and seek testing is really different. This is a very different situation we're in than we've been in the past.
Promises have been made in the past and broken in terms of the North Korean side. But a question on the diplomacy of this. Mm-hmm. It was unusual in terms of just on so many levels, but to see South Korean government officials appear in the driveway of the White House to mm-hmm. make this announcement about U.S. government relations, that was certainly unusual. But also the role of South Korea in mm-hmm. all of this, and going back, I'm thinking to Kim Jong-un's New Year's address, opened a small mm-hmm. window that the South Koreans jumped on in terms of come to the Olympics, grew through the Olympics. In a sense, and at a time when we don't have a permanent ambassador to South Korea, have we been outsourcing some of our diplomacy to South Korea?
I don't think so. And mm-hmm. again, now I'm going to have to pull out the crystal ball that
sure.
I said I don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a very appropriate way, and this is not a political statement, but the mechanics of the announcement, having the South Koreans make it, not inside the White House, for a couple reasons. We always must remember the stake that the Republic of Korea has in U.S.-North Korea interaction. And two, National Security Advisor Chung was in the room with Kim Jong-un, and he was in the room with President Trump. So who else should make a statement? Additionally, because of the nature of American politics, if the president had made it, a lot of the critique would have been on how he made it, what he said, and it sort of depoliticized the announcement. So I thought that was completely appropriate, and if we have, and I don't think we have, outsourced diplomacy, this gives us an opportunity to take some greater measure of control of interaction with North Korea.
Interesting. Let me pull you back to something that you do have direct experience with. When you were deputy commander at PACOM, the six-party talks were still in existence. Six parties, so this is North Korea, South Korea, the United States, Japan, and China, and Russia. I guess, do you see any utility for anything like that coming back, or has that ship sailed?
Perhaps in the future, but I think that ship had some leaks in the hull. Not because it was a bad idea at the time, probably a path worth pursuing, but all six of those parties, even the U.S. and its two treaty allies, South Korea and Japan, have different interests. And to try to negotiate, first of all, negotiating with North Koreans is very difficult, but try to negotiate with those competing priorities and reach an agreement that the North Koreans will hold to, really difficult. And the opportunity to get interaction directly between the U.S. and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is a big opportunity that I think we should seize, thoughtfully and carefully, but seize nonetheless.
Within this context, communication with Japan, when in the White House TikTok of how this happened, I was interested to see that as the South Korean officials went to the driveway, President Trump picked up the phone and called Prime Minister Abe. Previously, throughout the Olympics and the progression of this, Abe and others in Japan had been sort of approached the South Koreans in particular to say, don't agree to scaling back the exercises with the U.S., be cautious about that. And ironically, on the same day, or maybe not ironically, but the news of the steel tariffs came out. Japan was on the list for that. Do you see any concerns at all in terms of relations with Japan? Are they being brought along as they should? Do you see any room for distance there?
I think the phone call from the president to Prime Minister Abe was absolutely a very important step in this, so they weren't caught by as much surprise as I was. Or you were. But today, Prime Minister Abe made a statement where he said that he does not think North Korea is using this summit to buy time for further nuclear weapons development. And that's an indicator to me that he's on board with this approach. And it wasn't a negotiated summit. The United States truly did not give anything up. So while there's risk to it, there's not the usual risk to trying to negotiate with the North Koreans.
Abe also happens to plan to come to Washington before Trump goes to meet Kim as well. When you look at what is happening between the two Koreas, and Moon Jae-in will be meeting with Kim ahead of the Trump meeting, what are you watching for there in those developments or in those talks?
I'd be watching for anything that is discordant with the U.S. insistence on denuclearization or any crack in the or any seam on the position on the need for exercises. I don't expect that given Chung's statement at the White House, but other than that, they've got on-peninsula matters to worry about between North Korea and South Korea that are somewhat distinct from U.S. DPRK issues. And so I think it's a logical thing to have the communication. as long as there isn't anything that erodes the progress made in that statement and the 3 points that I mentioned, then it's important, but probably doesn't directly affect the summit and what might come out of it.
So if you are back at PACOM and you're looking ahead to the full Eagle exercises in the next round, do you make any adjustments? Do you make any changes? How are you thinking about what comes after that summit in terms of that next round of military exercises?
Absolutely not as far as changes to the exercises, because Kim has said he understands that they're necessary, must continue. I would be thoughtful about the sort of the public affairs signature of it, and I think that even more broadly, the United States needs to be thoughtful about what's said and tweeted and written, because Kim Jong-un's taking a great deal of risk in two regards. First, he's taking internal risk because he's meeting with Americans, and when you look at how Americans have been characterized to the North Korean populace for decades, to say it's unfavorable is an understatement. So now he's dancing with the devil, and we can't afford to make him look stupid.
Having previously, though, also made some adjustments in terms of his political opposition from uncles on down the line in terms of consolidating his power.
He has, but he still has to be the legitimate leader of North Korea. And, you know, about 20% of the math questions in primary school textbooks are problems about how many Americans were killed and how many Americans were captured, and they're not characterized as just Americans, but I won't share that with the radio audience. So, you know, this is a thread of the North Korean psyche that he's going directly against, and that's risky business.
Speaking of risky business, there has been talk about potential U.S., the phrase bloody nose used, a limited strike on North Korea. Number one, what do you think about that as a concept? Number two, any changes in the odds of things like that being considered given current circumstances?
Well, I think that letting Kim Jong-un know that his provocations hold military risk is important. Having said that, I also know from my military and especially combat experience that there is nothing simple in even a simple combat operation. There'd be risk of a North Korean retaliation. There'd be risk that we might not achieve the aims that we intended by some limited action, rather, against their nuclear capability. But, as is often said by people like me, we shouldn't take that option off the table. We should not seek to pursue it. I really thought that one of the most important tweets that came out was when, and there aren't that many tweets that come out from anybody that are that important, but when President Trump said, we are prepared to go hard in either direction, diplomatic or military. I thought that was important because it indicates that the United States is ready to pursue aggressively a diplomatic approach to denuclearization, as aggressively as we might pursue such a bloody nose strike, because it will take the hard work. Peace is harder than war. I know this.
General, thanks for your insights this morning. We're likely to have you back before this is all over. We appreciate
thank you, Bill.
Coming in.
Always a pleasure.
Retired Air Force Lieutenant General Dan Leaf, former Deputy Commander of U.S. Pacific Command and former Director of the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, performing music of Tchaikovsky, Glazunov, and Stravinsky, featuring the Hawaii debut of violinist Esther Yu this Saturday and Sunday at the Blaisdell, hisymphony.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, local students join a national walkout. But first, your quiz.
Today on The Conversation, we've been hearing about the recent diplomatic thaw between North Korea and the United States. In light of past military threats and scares, many Hawaii residents are probably breathing a little easier about the potentially softening relations. So in today's backyard quiz, we're looking back at the history of Koreans here in the territory of Hawaii. The first group of Korean immigrants landed in Hawaii in 1903 aboard the ship RMS Gaelic. Once in Hawaii, they took up jobs as laborers on sugar plantations. Their experience must have gone well because within 2 years, the population of Koreans in Hawaii had grown from less than 100 to over 7,000. For that first decade of the 20th century, immigrating Koreans were issued passports by the Imperial Korean Foreign Office. Those passports each contain the bearer's information written in three languages. And for today's quiz, we want to know what those languages were. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. We'll convene a summit later this hour with the answer. Students from both private and public schools are planning to walk out for 17 minutes tomorrow morning. It's to honor the memory of 17 people killed in a mass shooting at a Florida high school. They're calling it the National School Walkout for Safety. The Wall Street Journal reports that since 1990, there have been 32 school shootings across the U.S. Punahou sophomore Imiloa Borland talked with us about what spurred her to help organize the student-led events.
Our school, our high school part of Punahou, we are going to be meeting on the quad together, and there's going to be different stations. One station is where students are going to register to vote, so those are the seniors and some juniors who have turned 18 this year. There will be a station where students can write letters and cards to the victims of the Parkland shootings, their families and their friends, you know, messages of support and love. And there will be another section where students can just silently reflect on themselves and, you know, what they believe in and just trying to cope with the emotions that the shootings brought up. I've been working with students from other schools to help them talk to administrators and get a plan of what to say when they're meeting with their school principals and administration staff to help them make their own rally and to help them make sure that they're following all the guidelines and the rules necessary.
And so tell us, what struck you when you heard about the shootings over in Florida?
I just remember feeling just like, we have another one, you know, and that's not a good response to have. You know, each time there's a shooting, it's just there's another one, and that's not acceptable because we shouldn't be having another one and another one and another one. These are atrocious events that need to be stopped, and I remember just feeling so heartbroken, especially since the victims were my age. I was a freshman last year, you know, like that could have been me. Someone pulled a fire drill and I was in class, you know, so it struck home more than other school shootings because, like, I'm a high schooler and these were high schoolers killed. These are kids my age. They're 14, 15. I'm 15, you know? And it really put into perspective, like, I'm lucky to live in Hawaii where we have pretty good gun control. And, you know, I'm not immune from this. And the Parkland shooting really just helped solidify that for me. Like, I can't sit silent on this anymore. This is affecting me and my peers. Our school principal sent out an email to all of the teachers and said to plan a lesson that day that if students miss class, they won't be missing out on too much information, that they can easily catch up, and that if a student wants to participate in the walk, then they're welcome to, and they won't be penalized for missing class. And if a student doesn't feel comfortable or they don't want to participate, then that's fine, and they can stay in their classes. But we're really fortunate to have such a supporting administration staff that wants to help us cultivate our own voices and are super supportive of what we're doing and all of our ideas and our thoughts and our feelings.
And what's going to happen in those 17 minutes?
There's going to be just a collection of students who want to just think and reflect on the victims, you know, the people that could have been our friends and our siblings, you know. And it's just the time for us all to come together and to just really think about, you know, our values and just trying to cope and trying to try to work through all the emotions and the and what this shooting means to all of us.
That was Punahou's Emiloa Borland, who sat down with us in our studios yesterday. We also talked with Farrington High School's student body president, Francesca Aguilar.
So at 10 a.m., students are prompted to go to the front lawn, but if they don't want to go, it's totally fine. And we're going to start the ceremony with Oli by Ho'onani Kamai, and we're going to have 17 leis draped. So an MC is going to address our National Walkout Day and our hashtag, Govs for Safe Schools. And after that, we're going to read the names of all the 17, and we're going to release balloons.
Was there anything that struck you when you heard about the shooting in Florida, you know, that prompted you folks to take action and get involved?
I think the main thing that really struck us was we just need safety. There are so many children being affected by mass shootings that our main goal is just to protect lives and make sure our peers are safe.
And at one time, Farrington had a gang problem many years ago, but that's completely turned around.
Yeah.
You had incidents of violence there at the school.
Yes, that was a long time ago. But when I went into the school, I think it already dispersed and it was solved.
And then what else have you folks decided to do? Are you going to submit testimony on any of the legislation banning the bump stocks or, you know, what else?
So I'm actually going to encourage the seniors at Farrington who are 18 to vote during the midterm election. This is our chance for us to make a difference because as teens, as children, this is our future. And we want to make sure that we're trying to make a change for a better life.
Are you a senior?
I'm a senior, yes.
Okay, so you're getting ready to go off to college.
Yes.
And is that a concern for you, safety on a college campus?
Oh, yes, of course. When I do apply to schools, I look for safety levels. And I think this is really important because students need to be more aware of their surroundings and the difference they can make. So I feel like by having this optional walkout, it's going to educate not only the community, but also our students at Farrington High School that if things do go wrong, we can step in and make a say and do something about it. I think anywhere that we go, there's going to be some instances of violence. But I just hope with this walkout, we'll better educate people on how to be safer.
What about the school? What are they doing to make sure that the kids don't get, you know, written up if they leave class? Or
I think we're following the state guidelines where if they do walk out, it's going to be an absence, but that's voluntarily up to the student.
And other schools are planning to hold signs, light candles, and bring lei as part of the event to honor the memory of the slain students and educators and to talk about other events planned, including a nationwide rally on March 24th.
I'm Lei from Aloha Gatsoul. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HBR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, from Da Vinci to Darwin, how some great minds are finding inspiration through procrastination. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
Yesterday, we talked about the ongoing issue of transient vacation rentals in our communities. The hour really flew by. We had quite a few listeners whose calls didn't make it on air yesterday. We start today with Tanya in Kaimuki.
I want to know about the people who do vacation rentals and do pay their taxes and have no complaints from their neighbors. Why can't those people get a business license?
My name is Terry, and I'm calling from Mittalani, and I'm an Airbnb host. I think that there are other perspectives. A lot of times what we're hearing is just the complaints and the negativity. We're not actually hearing some of the positive impacts that this has, not only the financial gain, but for those neighbors and neighborhoods that are accepting of this, you know, a lot of the money that we make goes back into maintaining the house and making sure that the maintenance and upkeep is there, which provides, you know, pride of ownership for everybody involved. And also to mention that most of the times, tenants that are coming in, the nightly tenants, are just people looking to save a few dollars on their stay and be able to cook meals at home and stay in a comfortable place and make new friends. So hopefully there'll be more opportunity for some of the positive attributes, because it sounds right now there's nothing but some of the negative examples that are going out there.
This is Ziggy from the Kapoho area of the Big Island of Hawaii. The point that I just want to stress is that the majority of Airbnb hosts who I'm familiar with are completely law-abiding as far as the law is determined up to this point. We pay our taxes, both state, federal, and transient taxes. And what we would like is an inclusive set of rules that we'd be happy to follow. Thank you. Aloha.
We also heard from many of you via the TalkBack email. Helen wrote, "I agree with many of the comments of Mr. Price of Kailua. I do not want owners to have income as a hotel would. The neighborhoods are not zoned as hotel. The owners did not buy there expecting to have paying visitors next door. They do not gain income, just headaches from the short-term tenants. The least that the state of Hawaii or counties can do is register the vacation rentals and regulate and tax the income these landlords are making."
Nikki from Honolulu wrote, "We've been renting a small studio apartment in our family home to Airbnb guests for over 3 years with no complaints from anyone. We have a maximum of 2 guests at any one time and do provide off-street parking. Our guests are sleeping under our bedroom. If there were excessive noise or inappropriate behavior, we're right here to deal with it. But the issue has never come up. I cherish my quiet neighborhood and have deep respect for our neighbors, but I live in constant fear of being sighted and feel the need to hide our Airbnb from my dear neighbors. We would love to get some type of permit, but in non-resort areas, permits haven't been issued since 1989. I would also love to pay our transient accommodation and general excise tax, but I am afraid to file due to possible reprisals by the city and county of Honolulu. Without our Airbnb rental income, due to Hawaii's high cost of living, we would be unable to pay our children's college tuition. So, like thousands of other Airbnb hosts on Oahu, we continue to operate illegally. We feel really badly about this, but don't know how else to do it."
Another listener, Laamea, wrote via Facebook, "The real losers here are the residents of Hawaii who have to constantly compete when trying to purchase a home with all the investors who want to buy to rent out these properties as short-term rentals on sites like Airbnb. They're constantly driving the prices of homes here in Hawaii up and up. It's definitely a major factor in why those families who make over $100,000 a year can't afford to buy a home, and drives our monthly rental prices through the roof. The law doesn't defend us from the poachers of our land and neighborhoods. The people who make up our communities are left unprotected while all these accommodations are made for people who aren't even from here and contribute little to nothing to our communities. And we have just learned from House Tourism Chair Representative Richard Onishi that Senate Bill 2963 that addressed vacation rentals and which had a triple referral will not be heard. Instead, look for a move to gut and replace sections of the bill in another measure."
We thank you for your thoughts. You can always tell us what's on your mind by calling our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's now time for the reality check-in with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. The legislature is wading into some of the hiring practices of the state government this session. Specifically, there's a bill that passed the Senate that would end an exemption which allows the state government to create temporary positions, often using federal money. It was introduced by Senator Donovan Dela Cruz, and reporter Nathan Eagle joins us with the details. Nathan, good morning. What sort of positions are we talking about?
It's across the board. I mean, there's at least a dozen different departments listed in this. So it's everything from, you know, a HIMP pilot project to homeless sweeps under H-1 to broadband initiatives, homeland security, you name it. They've probably used this exemption.
And the department heads who testified on this, against this bill, saying that they need this mechanism to be able to respond quickly to needs that shift as life goes on in their various jurisdictions.
That's absolutely right. And it was across the board, a dozen different directors weighing in, all against. You know, Nolan Ascenda, for instance, the head of public safety, he's like, you know, you hear this stereotype all the time about government not being responsive enough, you know, to emergent problems. And this would just further that stereotype if the bill goes through.
And the response back from the sponsor, Donovan Dela Cruz, is basically one sort of a, this is creating jobs sometimes that then take on lives of their own. And while they may start as temporary jobs, they wind up eventually on the state payroll.
That's it. Yeah, he's very concerned about that. But also just, you know, in his words, you can't keep growing government like this. That's his big issue there. So he wants to put the brakes on that. And of course, then the directors themselves acknowledge to an extent anyway that, yeah, you know, sometimes we'll get these temporary positions and they will become permanent. But even that's with the legislature's approval.
So then in terms of, I don't know, anything in the middle in terms of compromise areas, Budget Director Laurel Johnston, I noticed that you talked to her and said that there may be some space in the middle in terms of having some caps, but also having some flexibility on the part of the directors?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, both sides see room for a compromise in this. And for Senator Dela Cruz's part, it's, well, maybe these could just be for short-term hires, maybe 90 days or less. And on her side, she's like, well, maybe we could just put a ceiling on the number of these temporary positions and you could hold us accountable to that.
So when we're looking for what happens next on this, what do you think?
Well, we're waiting for a hearing on the House side. It's been referred to the Labor Committee and the Finance Committee, so Labor will be the first stop, and that'll be up to the chair, Representative Aaron Ling Johansson.
All right. Well, Nathan Eagle, thanks very much for your time this morning, and thanks for his story. Nathan Eagle with today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. You can find that entire story and a lot more at civilbeat.org.
For decades, Hawaii has had some of the strictest animal quarantine rules in place in an effort to keep the island's rabies-free, but the rules are relaxing, with restrictions being front-loaded, reducing quarantine time. State veterinarian Dr. Raquel Wong explains what's being proposed.
The main change, significant change in this group, is going to be, number one, we are changing the pre-entry requirements, waiting periods that have been in existence since about 2003 for the direct airport release program, 5-day or less program. And that change basically is to change that timing requirement. Previously, it had to be done, at least the blood test, which is a rabies titer test, was done 120 days prior to the dog or cat's entry into the state. And so that's going to be reduced down to a 30-day lead time. The most current rabies vaccination is currently 90 days prior to the entry, and now that will be reduced down to 30 days as well. So you can see there is a timing difference, which can make it much more flexible for owners who are, you know, trying to travel with their pets.
Why the change?
Well, we've looked at the data. So a little bit goes back to the history of the disease control method, which is quarantine. And so from 1911, when it started, to about 1997, when the first modified program came into existence, there was no change. It was just the 120-day confinement. In 1997, there was a modified program, which led to a 30-day confinement with some pre-loading, pre-entry requirements that were fulfilled. After looking at that data, they reduced it down even further and said, we can front load even further. And now we have 120 days prior to entry into the state with these pre-entry requirements and then no confinement and inspection and the direct release to the airport. And that was in 2003. So this is just an evolution, the next evolution, which is looking at that data, being able to say, look, it doesn't significantly increase the introduction of the disease, so we're going to reduce down those wait times and everything should be fine.
Right. So basically then the science is saying it's okay. We can still be rabies free, but then make it easier on the pet owner.
Correct.
And then you also are modifying language for service animals. Explain that.
So the language is basically we're changing sort of the description that we use. So in our rules, we refer to service dogs. So we're just modifying, changing that from service dog to service animal to be more in line with the ADA rule. However, the actual rules still refer to service dogs.
Right, but the time doesn't change at all.
No, there's no change for the modified program that for service dogs.
And that is shorter than for a regular dog?
Yes, service dogs have a more flexible program.
Shorter time?
Yes.
And that's just because what they need to be with their
the understanding,
owner.
Yes, it's because they with their user, yes.
Okay. And so let's just, I guess, step back because we really did have very strict quarantine rules before, and we were hearing lots of criticism about that because a lot of pet owners thought it was a real hardship, you know, sending their animals here and then they have to be quarantined at the facility in Halawa for such a long time. And so what prompted that change?
I mean, part of it was that, you know, is that we quarantine is a long recognized disease control method, you know, that we use that you use that in other types of diseases to ensure that the disease is not going to be introduced to your naive population, and that's basically what a quarantine is. So that was an acceptable practice, or it is an acceptable practice. However, that sort of prompted the change. I mean, is the fact that when you look at the date at the risk, basically we're looking at the risk of how likely this virus is to be introduced in a vaccinated, in a well-vaccinated dog or cat. And when you look at that and examine that, you can see that the risk is, you know, the same, if not lower in a vaccinated animal versus an unvaccinated animal. So therefore the need for quarantine, which is a way of isolating that particular unvaccinated population, is not as necessary. And so therefore, by meeting those pre-entry requirements, you're going to, the owner can, or the animal can prove that it is protected against any potential exposure to the virus and will not transmit the virus if it is exposed.
And I imagine then this also is a plus for the state because we don't have to have such huge facilities, kennels, to quarantine a lot of these animals.
Yes, that is correct.
And our facility is aging and in Halawa.
Yes, yes. It's a large facility, or it is a large facility. And at one point, we were housing, you know, up to 800 animals back in the late 90s, mid-90s. And since then, the population has been reduced probably to about half, if not a third of that. And so we suspect that with the continued, sort of relaxing of the pre-entry requirements, more dogs and cats will be able to qualify for the inspection at the airport and release to their owners. And then our population that are housed at the station will start to drop as well.
Have we ever had a rabies case here?
Not through the quarantine system. There has been reports, if I remember correctly, there was a dog that had transited through Hawaii maybe around the mid-70s or so, that was a military animal that came from Asia. When it arrived in the U.S. mainland, the disease developed at that time, but it had been in Hawaii for a short period of time prior to going to the mainland.
Okay, but the exposure to other animals was minimal, I would imagine.
Yes, yes.
And then any other cases of rabies? I don't know, were there areas where it's still pretty
prevalent in other parts of the globe?
Yes. So actually, worldwide, rabies is still a significant disease. They report about 55,000 humans. And that's the real thing to remember about the disease itself, is that the true danger of the rabies virus is its impact to the human population. And so globally, in areas such as Africa and Asia, there's still a high incidence of human rabies as a result of exposure to rabid animals, the most likely species being dogs, usually through dog bites. So that's an important reason why we want to hang on to sort of this preventative inspection process to make sure that, you know, these animals are able to prove that they are free from disease prior to entry.
And it's kind of painful, isn't it?
Yes.
Or the treatment?
Yes. The treatment is painful and the disease itself is painful. So rabies is a progressive neurologic disease that is fatal in mammals. And all mammals can be affected by the virus. So it causes, you know, it's neurologic, so it causes central nervous system problems and eventually seizures and death.
Is it always fatal, or is there
In animals, it's always fatal. I believe in some humans, they have attempted. Once they become clinical, the chances of survival are very low. But if it is caught before the human becomes clinical, then there is post-exposure prophylaxis that can be taken so that it'll prevent the full clinical disease and then survival.
So if you're then traveling to places where this could be an issue in Asia or Africa, it just pays to be mindful.
Yes, you want to talk to your physician very much, especially if you're going to be visiting those areas where rabies is endemic, and talk to your physician about getting vaccinated before going.
Right, because I know there are monkeys out in the wild where there have been issues, you know, with those cases.
Sure, sure. I'm sure monkeys, bats, on the U.S. mainland, we usually, wildlife, any type of wildlife is a suspect, especially the skunks, raccoons, and the bats. Those are the big three on the continental U.S. And then in Asia, you're going to have other types of species that get exposed as well. So, yes.
We recently had a skunk turn up unexpectedly here.
Yes.
Did we check for rabies?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. And that one was negative.
Okay, and what about wallabies? I know we've got those wallabies, but is that an issue in Australia where they're from?
Not that I'm aware of, not okay. In Australia I'm from. Australia also is rabies-free, like Hawaii, and they have an actually more strict import process for the dogs and cats that are coming into their country. So, and they are very serious about that process. But the wallabies that are here are, because we're Hawaiian, you know, they have been living here their entire lives, the likelihood that they had it was very, very low. But, yeah. So that's a good thing, is that we don't have to necessarily worry about the disease presence in our wildlife, and that really we don't think about that particular aspect of being outside and being outdoors and what potentially we could expose to and what we couldn't be exposed to. The other thing I think I'd wanted to highlight is that the inspection process is not only important to ensure that the animals that are entering are free from disease, but the other thing that sometimes we forget about are exotic parasites. Primarily, I'm talking about ticks. So Hawaii enjoys the fact that we only really have two species of ticks that are reported. The first is the brown dog tick, and the second is a spinous ear tick, which is seen in large animals. We don't have things like the deer tick, which carries Lyme disease in humans or can transmit it to humans and dogs, and there are other types of dog ticks that we do not have here. So going through that inspection process visually examining these dogs and cats that enter, the staff is able to look for these types of ticks and then remove them. And also it's required that the animals are treated for ticks prior to entry into the state. So just another thing that we are looking for in this process.
Not just the rabies, but also other hitchhikers.
Yes, other types of hitchhikers as well.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
That was State Veterinarian Dr. Raquel Wong. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Dina Yoshimi from the Hawaii Roadmap Initiative. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for a start. Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet. Also, we find out what we can look for in our dark island skies, tapping into the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, Stargazers, look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in the southern skies early in the morning before dawn. The moon this week will be passing through its new moon phase. This, of course, means dark skies, perfect for stargazing here in the island.
And you said that you had a story this week, two spiraling galaxies colliding.
Yes, indeed. The Hubble Space Telescope has captured a spectacular image of a pair of spiral galaxies known as ARP256 that are on course for a cosmological smash. The two galaxies are located around 350 million light-years away in the direction of a constellation called Cetus, the Sea Monster, which is actually visible from Hawaii. The two galaxies are at the mercy of their mutual gravitational attraction, which is drawing them together and ultimately will cause them to collide.
And we have this image posted at hawaiipublicradio.org with Stargazer, and in the image it looks like arms reaching out to each other?
It really does. This is one of the most beautiful things about merging galaxies. As they get closer, they begin to influence each other's shape. This is caused by the gravitational forces that cause rivers of stars to flow out from one galaxy to another, even though they are hundreds of thousands of light years apart.
The amount of stars that are in each of these is about how many, do you think?
Hundreds of billions of stars.
And so when you're looking at that picture yourself as an astronomer, Christopher, do you think that there's any life in that thing, or is that just a big, beautiful bunch of nothing?
In fact, it would be really hard to think that there was no life at all. These are galaxies that are composed of stars, just like our own Milky Way. And we know that stars in our galaxies have planets, and planets such as the Earth have life. So I imagine those galaxies are full to the brim with organisms.
And you're thinking the organisms are more like something that you'd find in a rock, like a little microbe, or more like a sea monkey, or more like the Jetsons?
That's the $64 million question.
We'll be hoping one of these days, Christopher, that that's the kind of answer that we're going to be getting to talk about here.
Well,
on,
let's hope so.
On Stargazer. It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much for the report.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii. Walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, featuring ZipPass, a new online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
In today's backyard quiz, we looked back at the history of Koreans in Hawaii. Specifically, we were remembering the first group of immigrants who came to Hawaii from Korea. They arrived in territorial Hawaii aboard the steamer RMS Gaelic in 1903 as citizens of the Korean Empire. As such, they bore passports identifying them as citizens of the Korean Empire. In today's quiz, we ask you to identify the three languages printed on those imperial passports. It may surprise you to learn that Korean was not one of them. Reflecting the economics of the time and the most common destinations for migrants, Imperial Korean passports identified their bearers in English, French, and classical Chinese. However, those trilingual passports were not around for long. When Korea was annexed by Japan in 1910, Koreans became citizens of the Japanese Empire and were issued Japanese passports.
And we do have a winner, a shout out to Asher Robinson of Wailua, who got it right. And that is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state. Our Derek Malama joins us this morning for a look at some of the events that are happening in our community that might be a little under the radar. And tomorrow we have a Holocaust visitor or survivor who will speak in Hilo.
That's right. Goldie Lefkowitz now lives in Kona and is in her mid-90s. And you can hear from her firsthand what she experienced during World War II and what we can learn from her. And this is part of a brown bag lunch series in the office of the prosecuting attorney in Hilo, and it starts at noon tomorrow.
Okay, and what's this about a pauhana talk with three artists in downtown Honolulu?
The Hawaii State Art Museum Gallery Shop is hosting a wine down Wednesday. And wine is in the beverage. It's a talk with artists George Woolard, Mary McGrath, and Kathy Merrill Kelly. We'll discuss their recent collaboration at the museum and their creative process in making art together. A complimentary light poo-poo and wine, of course, will be served. Go to our website to RSVP for this free talk tomorrow at High Sam at 6 p.m.
And Make Hawaiian Cordage tomorrow in a workshop in Hawaiian Volcanoes National Park. What's that about?
Okay, Uncle Larry Kuamo'o will demonstrate how to make traditional cordage or kaula from native Hawaiian plants like hau and hala. Kaula making was a necessary skill for making tools, canoes, homes, and much more. And this workshop, sounds interesting, is tomorrow at 10 a.m. in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, and it's free on top of that.
All right, that's what I love, free events.
Yes, me too.
Okay, thanks, Derek.
Sure.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at the events in our community that might be a little under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000, providing a new Read, Discuss, Read instructional model built in partnership with Dr. Doug Fisher with the goal of improving student reading achievement. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
And that wraps up the conversation for today. Up tomorrow, the Hawaii Supreme Court hearing oral arguments in the 30-meter telescope sublease case. We'll get a recap of the case from our reporter Kuvehi Hiraishi and discuss what this ruling could mean for the project.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line, leave us a comment. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. And you can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
And if you missed any of this show or you're curious about finding a past one, maybe you want to find out more about the short-term rentals, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.